from the Samira Foundation, this is Demystifying NMO and MOG, where we bring together the world's foremost experts, the doctors dedicated to studying it, and the patients who live with it every day. With support from Genentech. Welcome back, everyone. As the Samira Foundation has grown internationally, we started to see the inequalities in care experienced by patients throughout the world. And before we can create positive change, we believe that we need to better understand the variables that are in play and how they impact a patient's everyday life. Now, as NMO and MOG patients, caregivers, and clinicians, we all understand the challenges of getting a diagnosis and accessing our treatments. But think what it would be like navigating those same challenges, but in the aftermath of a natural disaster like the fires in Lahaina. Or how do you find answers when facing structural challenges in the healthcare system? Maybe there are clinicians who don't know how to recognize immunological diseases, let alone have the diagnostics and appropriate treatments. How do you get care when living in a conflict zone like the Ukraine? How do you maintain the continuity of care when you're forced to flee your home or your healthcare system has been decimated and collapses and your medical records are gone? This is the reality for far too many people. In 2022, the UN estimated that more than 2 billion people live in a conflict zone, and 84 million people were forcibly displaced. Now, in 2023, 110 million people were displaced, and that number is expected to balloon to more than 130 million people by the end of 2024. Now, to give you a sense of those numbers of the displaced people, it would be the equivalent of the combined population of California, Texas, Florida, New York, Pennsylvania, and Colorado. The numbers are just staggering. So today we welcome back a guest from season 3, Dr. Farah Mateen. In episode 26, she joined us to talk about socioeconomic impact of NMO. And today we're going to look at another aspect of her work, global health, humanitarian and natural disasters, and social determinants of health. I don't think you can have a discussion about the state of NMO and MOG throughout the world without Dr. Mateen. She has spent more than a decade studying neurocritical care in developing countries, and she brings incredible insight into a very complex issue. She's published a series of articles on the topics, and the most recent papers shed light on the unique medical challenges of those who are forcibly displaced, and also considerations for addressing the existing gaps in care. So, without further ado, Dr. Farah Mateen. So, welcome back. I'm excited that you could come back and talk more about your work. For anyone who missed out on the first episode we did, which was from season 3, first, they should be ashamed of themselves. And second of all, they should go back and listen to it. We had talked about the impact of NMO on employment and financial burdens that come along with it. But today we're going to be talking about NMO and MOG throughout the world, specifically in developing countries and global inequities. So your work focuses a lot on the social determinants of health. What led you down that path?
Well, hi, Brian. First of all, thanks so much for having me today and for covering this topic. So I've always been interested in vulnerable populations or the folks who aren't really part of the mainstream clinical trials or the literature. And I have a PhD in public health, but I did that after my neurology residency. So I always wanted to do global work or work with marginalized or vulnerable populations. But originally I was told that that wasn't really a part of neurology or that that wasn't a way I could focus my career. And I really loved neurology and I really loved public health and those sorts of problems as well. And so I was able to thankfully start thinking about those in synergies or in intersections. NMO is even more complicated in the sense that it's a rare disease, as you know well, and trying to figure out what is the public health impact of a rare disease. And then in countries where NMO may not be even well recognized is a different challenge altogether.
That's really interesting, looking beyond specifically just the disease and looking at, you know, the multifactorial nature of neurological conditions in and of itself and how they feed into things. In your most recent article, Rectifying Global Inequities in Neuromyelitis Optica Diagnosis and Treatment, could you just give us like a brief overview of some of the key challenges and the unique considerations with providing neurological care in such resource-limited settings?
Well, this was an article. It's really a personal commentary based on my many years of traveling in different low and middle income countries, working with collaborators in those countries, sometimes neurologists, sometimes psychiatrists, sometimes frontline healthcare workers who are not MDs, maybe, you know, traditional healers or nurses or people who are encountering neurological patients. And I've traveled to many countries, thanks to my PhD in international health, and then really my career focus on faculty here at Mass General for the last 10 years. And I wanted to synthesize some of my experiences and, you know, not least of which was talking directly to patients and trying to figure out why are people in the situations they're in. And then also being situated in the United States in an academic medical center and seeing the, you know, the great privilege that it is to see the new advances and the new disease modifying therapies and NMO, and also appreciate the complexities of getting them and the costs of them, and to think about how widely inequitable the world can be for specific diseases. And in public health, you know, we've had a lot of experience with other diseases that are, you know, much more common, like HIV or even stroke. But then to think about NMO as almost like, it's not, of course, cancer, but in some ways it has a model that's similar. It's a chronic disease. And if it's not treated, it can be deadly in some patients, not everybody, of course, but there have been really great NGO and multilateral initiatives to start thinking about how do we access potentially life-saving and life-changing treatments for patients who can't get them. And there have been examples in other diseases that could be used and could be that experience could be used for NMO. So I wanted to start thinking about how is it possible in many countries in the world, people don't even know they have NMO. They may be blind or may not be able to walk, and they have no idea why. You know, they may be getting the wrong treatment or maybe getting no treatment in many cases. And then the other side of the world, we've got treatments that are upwards of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and trying to reconcile where we are in the world today. And if there was no treatments or advances, in some ways there would be more equity, but that's not great either if everybody's not getting anything. So how do we, you know, sort of reconcile this great news that we have, good science, and also make sure that science it can reach some of the people who really need it?
You had said that a tipping point, tipping a disease from potentially deadly to chronic survivable condition is possible. And that wasn't a perspective that I had looked at before. And then really thinking about it, it kind of hit a little bit hard to think that, you know, without treatment, without access to treatment and diagnosis, a proper diagnosis and timely diagnosis really changes the long-term outcomes. Elaborating on that a little bit more, you talked about the need for access to testing and improved diagnostic accuracy. Can you talk a little bit more about the diagnostic challenges in situations like that?
Yeah, I mean, actually, this stems from way back in 2015/2016 when I was in Sudan, in Khartoum, at an African training course. And I was representing at the time the AAN, the American Academy of Neurology, but it was a course run mostly through the Europeans. And but it was involving African neurologists in training from approximately 20 countries. And we surveyed them and we said, what is like a test that you most want that you can't get? And this is mostly sub-Saharan Africa. And, you know, I was thinking we'd hear, you know, MRI or, you know, something that, you know, sort of, you know, that's what I would have guessed. But actually what we heard was aquaporin 4 antibody. And I don't know why that was the consensus or the highest, you know, response, but it certainly was. And it was eye-opening to me to think, well, this is actually, you know, easily achievable compared to some of the more expensive tests we do. And it's interesting to me that people are really thinking about this and can't get it. And as you know, the aquaporin 4 antibody hasn't been around it's been around for a long time, but we only figured it out, you know, as a field about 20 years ago now, thanks to, you know, Dr. Lennon and the Mayo team. And I was lucky enough to have my residency at Mayo in, you know, the mid-2000s. And it just, you know, was easy for us to get at that time to test and think about. We were, you know, in the sort of the area where a lot of discussions and early work was going on. And then there was all these folks who really wanted to know, is it NMO? Is it, you know, is it MS? If you don't have spinal cord imaging, if you don't have the antibody, it's a bit of a guess. And I work a lot in West Africa, in the Republic of Guinea, where I see a lot of folks, and really it's a real privilege to be there. And I was, neurology is on the second floor, which it often is in many hospitals, but there's no elevator. So I was going into work one day and I saw four people carrying this one young man up the stairs. And I was like, oh, I wonder where he's going. And then I realized he's coming into my office, even though we were doing epilepsy clinic that day. And he had paralysis. He couldn't walk. There's no elevator. There's no wheelchair. So you have to get carried around. And he came to my office and I thought, I wonder if this young man has NMO. And I couldn't answer the question, actually. I thought, well, clinically he looks like it, but I can't do the test. And then it's like, what do you treat, or do you try to get more tests, or, you know, how can you even coming from a wealthy institution, how can I even make the resources work for this man? Actually, it turns out in Guinea we don't have access to even the usual disease modifying therapies that are used off label in the US. So to get rituximab is a challenge. To get mycophenolate or azathioprine, which are still not my preferred choices for a DMT. I couldn't get those. You could get a little bit of steroids, but we all know those are, I think, as we heard from some of the patients in some of my prior studies, those are the devil, according to some of my patients.
Right.
And then they have cyclophosphamide. And then it's like, wow, do you go all the way to cyclophosphamide without a diagnosis exactly? And what are the implications of that for patients? And what are the costs? And, you know, how do you get to the diagnosis in a, you know, meaningful way? And so that's led to some other work that I've had the luck to do with different collaborators, both at Mass General with Michael Levy's lab, and also now working with the Mayo Clinic's lab on aquaporin 4, trying to think about how can we do point of care aquaporin 4 testing? And shouldn't that be, you know, easy enough that we can start thinking about this as a solution for people, at least to get to the diagnosis so we can make informed decisions? As you probably know, there are three drugs now on the essential medicines list, which is the World Health Organization sort of recipe of drugs that should be available. And it's, you know, it's listened to by many ministries of health. There are three drugs on the list now for MS. So one of them is ocrelizumab, and then the other one's glatiramer acetate, and the other one is cladribine. So those are not NMO treatments, of course, but at least neuroimmunology is coming up and it's getting advocated for. And so, you know, it's not a guarantee if you have NMO, you can even get the right treatment, but at least we can start figuring out who has it. We don't even know the fundamental epidemiology in many places.
You had mentioned the importance of developing some best practices and some guidelines. So would those be specific in context to country or region? How would you go about developing something like that when there are so many variables?
Yeah, no, I think that's an important consideration. So sometimes in the literature, we talk about low and middle income countries as though they're like one place. But the reality is that that's the majority of the world's population right there. You know, that's at least three quarters of it, if not much more. And that's where most of the young people live, too. So we really have to think both globally about what are minimum standards and what are the humanitarian or basics we really must offer for patients with neurology in general, but NMO specifically here. And then also what's regionally important. So I know that South America and Central America have a variety of very established collaboratives and have done some work about what their state-of-the-art care is, and even talking about regional differences within that geography. And you know, they're very organized. There are other parts of the world where there are still very few neurologists, and they don't have time to focus on one disease, or you know, basically there are no equivalent, you know, subspecialty societies. So there is different work to be done there, even trying to figure out, you know, how do we access better imaging for these patients? How do we pay for the drugs if they're needed? So there are very different levels of need, depending on which country is involved, and even which patient is involved in a specific country, because we know that there's such a rising middle class in middle income countries. You know, you can take a, you know, country that's traditionally called lower middle income, India would maybe an example, or parts of Africa. And it depends who you are, not where you are, on what level of care, and how much income you personally have, not how much income is in a country. So there's a lot of nuance. In West Africa, where I work, you know, sometimes people have funds to travel and they can go to a neighboring country, or Europe, for example, or the US, and they can get the care that they need. But many times people can't. We don't really have, you know, strategies across the board in many countries. So there's a lot of work to be done. There's not one size fits all. And I think foundations can be really good at setting minimum standards, trying to figure out who is being left behind, or who can we help? If we have charitable opportunities, where should they be directed? So those sorts of things, and like even consensus about what is the minimum for NMO care, because it is still, you know, a rare disease, and there is still sort of debate on some of the best practices, that, you know, we should figure out what do we need to offer folks. And I think there's a lot of interest in the field now, through foundations and even through pharmaceuticals, and through academics and students, I might add as well, trying to figure out how do we help. And so I think there's some work that can be done in terms of consensus building, bringing people together in terms of guidelines, and even just knowing what is happening. I think it's very unclear often what is the state of NMO care in many places. Unless there's a published paper, or unless somebody's taken on the task of reporting, we really have no idea how many people have NMO. In fact, even in this country, the epidemiology of NMO is not confirmed. There's some estimates, but so we shouldn't expect from poor countries what we can't do ourselves either.
No, excellent point. And I think your point about foundations and the work and the role that they can play is a really excellent one. I know from my experience, it seems like the foundations are doing a lot of work from the ground up. We're being contacted by patients and family members of patients who are like, you know, hey, my family member has this. Do you think it could be NMO or MOG, so on and so forth? And it starts that discussion. And so raising awareness through that means seems to be at least a start in getting resources into the hands of clinicians out there who may not be aware of the disease, which kind of leads me to the next question about education. Access to specialized training and expertise is a concern in everywhere, but especially in resource limited settings. How can healthcare professionals in these regions be better equipped to handle cases like this? And what role does education play in addressing those challenges? It's kind of hard to say, because it's one of those, you know, you don't know what you don't know scenarios, but how can we go about trying to address some of those issues?
I have a few thoughts on it. One is that there are some countries where there are NMO clinics that have hundreds of patients, and those neurologists know so much about NMO, more than most, you know, American neuroimmunologists, because the volume is so high in specific countries where they've collected patients into specific clinics. And we learn a lot from those practices. And I've met physicians in Mexico or China, and the number of NMO patients that they have is so much higher than our practices. So I think, you know, they have a lot that we can learn from in high income countries. I just, you know, start with that. So I think that there's like reciprocal learning that could occur in many countries. There may be more NMO in certain places, and NMO we assume is the same everywhere. And that's probably the case, but it would be good to know. We don't really know what causes NMO. So, you know, some of the things in the MS literature where we've done global epidemiology, we've learned, you know, vitamin D, latitudinal gradients, that kind of thing. And in NMO, I think we still have all those basics to still figure out. in terms of, you know, education, there's like a lot of interest, I think, whenever I go to different countries about learning about NMO, but there aren't so many opportunities. And so I think there's starting to be discussions, can NMO days occur? Those have happened to some extent, but they don't happen in a regular basis. I think COVID sometimes shut some things down that we're building. So I think that there's still a lot more to be done in terms of adding on to professional society events. In the United States, we have, around the academic meetings, there's like a resident engagement organization, or summits is what ACTRIMS calls it. So, we have the opportunity in other countries as well to do the same. And to figure out how that's going to happen, I think, is sometimes the challenge, but I think there is real interest. And as you know, we're separating out MOG, Aquaporin 4, there's the seronegative group, and there's also, other things like ADAM and other autoantibody diseases. And those are really exciting parts of neurology if you're a practitioner, because it's new and we have options. And that's, I think, why people go into some of these fields, is because it's such a, exciting and new and advancing area, and we have things to offer patients. And so there is a real interest, I think, in trying to figure out, are we offering the state-of-the-art care? And even if you don't have it in front of you today, doesn't mean that you won't get it and it won't come. And so it's always good to be ahead of that learning curve.
We've seen a rapid expansion of healthcare technology. Do you think things like digital health and telemedicine are realistic avenues that could help bridge some of these gaps in education and just access to care and diagnostics?
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of partnerships around the world that are still very fertile ground for telemedicine and for other digital health initiatives. There's online lectures via Zoom those have become normal now, whereas before those it would have been extraordinary. And telemedicine generally is a very good option. I think sometimes we're overregulated. Physicians are licensed by state or country, and there's all sorts of bureaucracies. But in terms of like the disease and the interest and the the relationships between neurologists, there's a huge amount of willingness and desire to work together. And there have been different platforms that I've been involved in. Sometimes it's a what they call asynchronous, so a doctor somewhere may not be a neurologist will put a case onto a platform, maybe in a humanitarian emergency, and say we think it's this, we made this plan, is this appropriate? And then neurologists can answer within a day or two, and then provide the best available advice that they can. But then the person in the country is still making the decisions. So those are ways that you can have specialist involvement, but not in real time. And then there are also, just informal interactions between neurologists all the time. One thing that we didn't talk about yet, which I think might be relevant, is how common it is now for pharmaceutical trials to recruit outside of high-income countries. And so we've seen, because NMO is rare and because the prevalence is probably higher in other countries, we're seeing often predominant enrollment in middle-income countries outside of the US and low-income countries as well. And trying to think about, well, these are the folks who are enrolling in our sort of grade, class one level data generation. So they probably do know a ton about NMO, and they have a lot of trials experience now too for NMO. So how do we marshal all that and think about, we're learning from these trials, we're learning from these sites. Often there's more than 10 sites that it takes to enroll in one RCT. Phase 3 RCT. So there is a global network already in place, even if it wasn't meant to be built as a network, it was through a clinical trial. But other fields like cardiology, for example, have had global trials, and then they get global networks as a result. And you learn a lot even through secondary analyses. So I think there is a future in that as well. But I would just say, you know, we are very dependent on global work now in NMO, just because of the small sample size that we have in any one location.
I was actually going to mention that because you had talked about generating evidence on treatment choices and the importance of clinical trials. And so it's interesting to see that working kind of from a global perspective in terms of recruitment, it's obviously going to provide a diversity of patient sampling and definitely pay dividends in multiple ways. So are there any specific models or initiatives that are promising that we can adapt? You mentioned cardiology, that we can adapt to the work in learning more about NMO and making sure that people are able to access care?
Yeah, no, I think there's a ton that could be done. And I would say, so, you know, when I wanted to do NMO and global health, everyone's like, how are you going to do that? Or how do you make that happen? And if I would have gone to, you know, NIH or traditional funding body, I don't think they would have been able to, or, you know, that wouldn't be very traditional for them to fund foundational work. So I really want to emphasize that foundations have a major role to play here. So many years back now, I asked the Smyer Foundation if they'd be interested in a global atlas on NMO, which many diseases have. And it was a bit of a flyer, you know, it seemed like a good idea, but who is really going to put their weight behind it? And the Smyer Foundation said, well, you know, basically we'll give this a try. And I really appreciated that, because until that time, we didn't really know who even has access to aquaporin 4 antibody, who has access to MOG, who has access to OCT, et cetera, et cetera. So it was not work that was going to get done through a traditional agency or even through, I think, traditional researchers. I was very lucky that, you know, that somebody was interested other than me in this topic. And I think that foundations do have that seed funding, that flexibility, the imagination, the insight, the patient voice, all of those come together in this really good soup of, you know, creativity and risk taking that others wouldn't. And then after somebody takes a lead on those things, other people join in because they're like, oh, that's not such a bad idea after all. And you know, other things have come along that way too, like patient reported outcomes and just how do we incorporate all the stakeholders. So that's one model that I think has certainly helped me as a neurologist interested in this topic. And I think some of my colleagues, be heard on some of the access and availability issues. Other things that I would say that have worked in other fields, they may have more funding actually in other fields. So we know that neuroscience on the global health level is underfunded. So things that are well-funded, more infectious disease or maternal child health. And of course, those are extremely important. But in terms of the burden of disease that neurological disorders have, we're very underfunded and it hasn't been a traditional kind of area for people to go into. So we can learn from other fields that have a more sort of robust global health presence. And CML was the one disease, like chronic myeloid leukemia, is the disease that I mentioned in the paper and has come up in past discussions. And what that is, it's a malignancy, but it's a, you know, it comes from a genetic translocation on a certain chromosome. And that was described, you know, years and years ago now, but they just discovered a targeted treatment. It turned out it was an expensive treatment and it was being used. It was successful. And then lo and behold, many countries and patients in many countries couldn't get it. And then this was really, my understanding, I listened to this lecture, this one woman who I think had a family member who had CML, and she's like, well, we have to do more. And I went to a lecture that she had given, and she showed the photos of all the people whose lives were saved by getting Gleevec, which was the drug name. And it was just all over the world, this person, this country, and this is what they're doing now. And they're living a normal and sort of usual life, and you would never know that they had CML. And I was like, wow, isn't this like miraculous? This was, you know, the science took it so far, but this single woman saw the need and took it that much further. And I think NMO is poised to take that same sort of leap in terms of implementation, just like that drug was. And so what could have been a really, you know, life-threatening disease became treatable. And here we are in the same model and potentially could execute. So I think that would be really exciting to see that level of implementation and sort of life-changing type of work. So I'm hopeful that NMO will follow that kind of model. There are other models too, of course. They usually are, you know, there's a lot of discussion in global health about, do you make horizontal inputs, i.e. build up the primary healthcare system, or sort of the rising tide that lifts all boats? Do you kind of bring everything up to a certain level, or do you do vertical programs, which are disease-specific programs that are helping people with a specific diagnosis? In neurology, the most famous vertical program is for polio. And polio is totally different, other than it does cause paralysis too. But it's, you know, we know it's from a virus, and it's been a multi-billion dollar initiative. Many famous people have taken that on, including Bill Gates himself, and, you know, thankfully have made enormous progress. But that's a vertical disease program. So they really wanted to eradicate polio. So, you know, there's a little bit of discussion, like, how do you influence neurological care? Do you build up the bottom in terms of, you know, making sure everyone with myelitis or optic neuritis gets a diagnosis or gets some treatment? Or do you just say, I want to eliminate certain outcomes from NMO? The latter has been more traditional and may make sense for rare diseases, but also needs a champion. So those are some of the issues.
Definitely some opportunities for some interdisciplinary collaboration there.
Yeah.
In the paper, you were talking about ensuring continuity of NMO care. It made me think about the work you had done with forcibly displaced persons, and it was talking about being able to maintain documentation and continuity of care. But you had mentioned North-South and South-South regional networks.
Yeah, so I guess to answer the question, North-South would be, you know, for example, you know, Norway collaborating with Uganda. You know, so somewhere that's like the global North is often considered to be the wealthier, higher income group. It's Japan or Canada, or, you know, Europe, Australia counts too, and right. Even though they're not technically North. But, you know, that model. So that model, working with a resource limited or lower income kind of strata country. The South-South is different thinking. You know, it's like, you know, would a neurologist in Peru collaborate with a neurologist in Guinea? And, you know, there may be benefits to both levels of partnership. So, you know, for example, if I teach my colleagues in West Africa about eculizumab, is that useful information to them? Sort of, yeah. You know, they're understanding the biology, and maybe they'll get that form of medicine one day, or maybe they'll have patients who come and go and get that drug. But then there are also like challenges that are shared across resource limited settings, or different practices that may be really appropriate in two locations that can learn from each other, that have nothing to do with high income countries. Maybe the way of training is the same, or the language is the same, or just the like healthcare system is structured in a certain way that's, you know, rational, and it's shared in two countries. You know, the US system is basically impossible to replicate, thankfully, anywhere else. And so it's a very complicated healthcare environment. And it's not necessarily the case that we should be teaching the whole world how to operate like us. So just to be, you know, really honest, there may be things that other countries are doing much, much better. And to try and take that like level of imperialism out of it, and to say that we all have something to learn from each other, and it doesn't necessarily have to involve a high-income country at all. So that would be one thought. And then I think your first question, Brian, was
ensuring continuity of care. And it made me think about the forcibly displaced persons and record keeping and the important role that past medical history and medical documentation plays in making sure that a person can receive the most appropriate care.
Yeah, so continuity of care is probably an unsung sort of part of medical practice. And, you know, we have the good fortune of electronic medical records in our practice and many practices around the world. And that can be taken for granted, but it also can be taken advantage of. And so there's a lot of nuance in medical records in terms of people who are in a country where they may not trust the government. They may not have any reason to trust their healthcare system. They may be on the move themselves. And a lot of folks may not be literate to know that they're getting like appropriate documentation, or may not be able to read this sort of scrawl of their doctor, or, may not realize it's important to take that notebook with them if they have to flee, for example. And also just, you know, it's complicated to have neurological conditions. So a lot of people are already, you know, busy with that, never mind worrying about whether they have their paperwork with them. So it's really helpful, though, for the patient and for the person treating to know what's been tried and what sort of infections have been, you know, occurred. Have the vaccinations been up to date? There's a lot to think about in terms of not just the disease modification, but also things like pain management and spasticity and those sorts of elements of symptoms of NMO, and then also any comorbidities. And having that information can be very helpful and time saving, so that, you know, past things aren't repeated if they're unhelpful. And if there is a serious, you know, infection history, obviously you would want to know that before making any big decisions. And there may be things that the patient remembers that are not in the record and vice versa. So I think that it doesn't obviate a good interview, but it's something that, you know, has come up in the refugee literature a lot, and forcible displacement. And when things, you know, natural disasters, when the medical record is wiped away, basically, or when you can't trust to have the medical record stored, because that means that, you know, people know something about you, or your, you know, if you had a head trauma, maybe you were in a fight, or, you know, there's certain things that really people don't trust the system. And so trying to think about ways people can be owners of their own data and have that portability is really something people are thinking about as a field.
Definitely so. I know, reading through your work on humanitarian emergencies and natural disasters, and the work with forcibly displaced persons was a real eye-opener. I know how difficult it is to receive care for a rare disease in quote-unquote a modern healthcare system. And we frame survival very differently than people in other parts of the world. And it was a real eye-opener to look at the different factors that were involved. It was excellent work, excellent perspectives. There are some themes there that can carry over and really bolster the way that we're doing things in general.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, no, I think that there's a lot that we can learn from vulnerable populations. And this has been an area of, you know, sensitivity. So we have these people who are in, you know, critical humanitarian circumstances. And, you know, should we be researching as well while we're, you know, seeing these things happen? And how can we learn how to provide the best neurological care when these humanitarian emergencies occur? Because we know that they're not going to stop, unfortunately. So can't we get better at providing care? And the other thing about humanitarian emergencies is they're lasting a long time now. So they're not, you know, a few days or a week. Some of them are going years, we're seeing in Ukraine now, for example, or generations, as we're seeing in the Middle East or even parts of sub-Saharan Africa, where people are born in refugee camps and some people die in refugee camps. And just thinking about what models of care can we provide these people. And so neurology hasn't traditionally been a part of programming for humanitarian emergencies. It's certainly not been prioritized. Polio may have been, or some vaccine preventable illnesses, even leprosy, if anybody remembers much about that. But those have been relatively successful programs, but how do we take that knowledge and transfer it to chronic disease and to rare disease and to, you know, make that part of how we deliver, you know, modern day care. And a lot of people who are in humanitarian emergencies are young adults, children, and also increasing number of elderly. So it's a different population than some of these models have been developed for, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So there's more to learn in terms of even thinking about vision and spinal cord and then delivery in a continuous fashion. So it's easier to make donations when they're once, you know, for healthcare and parachute things in or, you know, have something drop off. When you need to continue to provide care over time, epilepsy is another great example of this. Like, you can't just treat people once and walk away. You need to be able to continue that medicine. Otherwise, you haven't solved the problem. So NMO is the same. You know, you can't make a one stop and solve the problem.
You've been studying neurological disorders in resource limited settings for well over a decade now. Where have you seen the most progress, and are there any areas that are specifically lagging?
In terms of progress, I'd say, like, academically, kind of, you know, it's a job now. It's something that you can legitimately study, and people have recognized it. It's a section of, you know, different academies and associations, and there's a lot of people who really want to learn about it. And I'd say it's very common for people who want to go into neurology now to want to do global health and neurology. So the field, partly due to the younger generation, but not exclusively, has really developed. And it's not like a hobby. It's not just like, oh, you know, this is something you want to do on the side. It's a legitimate career. And that's really a good thing, because there's a lot of work to be done. And the literature is getting, you know, better. And you know, there's better quality data, and we're getting better at working together just through things like the internet. And you know, basic development over time has advanced our field. Maybe not even neurology, but like the technologies of it. So that's been really cool, and point of care and better diagnostics are, you know, I'm part of a, not related to NMO, but, you know, I did early work on portable EEG using an app. And when I started that, everyone's like, oh, that's kind of crazy. And now, you know, the computing power has gotten to a certain point where it's not crazy. So I think we can keep going in that direction around point of care and even patient-based diagnostics, where people can diagnose themselves now. And I think AI is going to be really interesting. Maybe we can obviate some of the healthcare workers and leap over some of those shortages. In terms of work to be done, I think, you know, we still haven't solved basic problems about access and availability. And I know there's been a lot of, not a lot, but some interest. And there's been a new WHO resolution through the World Health Assembly on neurological disorders. But that was just, you know, a couple of years ago now. It's a 10-year plan. But I mentioned earlier that compared to their burden, neurological disorders have not received their due attention and funding. And whenever there's a resolution that's not necessarily a funded one, I'd say in terms of research support, we're still in a very old model. For example, through National Institutes of Health, where, you know, it's actually getting stricter on working across borders when we know that it makes more sense for science, especially, to work together. So a lot of the general trends around countries being more focused on themselves has not been progress. And there's still many people in the world who don't know they have a neurological condition, who aren't treated with basic medicines that have been around for even like decades. And that's really sad to watch. So I think we haven't done very good at like lobbying and like pounding the table and advocacy and just saying, like, you know, these are important disorders, and how do we like stop ignoring them? So so I think that there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of disease states. I think one of the challenges moving forward will be how do we maintain anything close to equity for global health? So as the medications become more plentiful and often more expensive, that actually increases the challenge because there's actually more people are missing out on globally. And so somebody has to, you know, think about the ethics of this as well. And there's not a huge priority or burden on drug developers. So it has to really go somewhere else. How do we, you know, some companies are taking on their own auspices to do a lot of charitable work and some don't. And there have been like report cards online about which companies have given the most to the developing world. And that's sort of helpful, but it's not neurology specific. So I think even just reporting and clarity on what's going on is still lacking. And that would help. At least we could have accountability on what we're doing. But, you know, we still don't have neurologists in every country in the world. So that's going to be a starting point. And I don't think we've done as well on like brain drain for neurology either. I think we still find that neurologists in low-income countries may be on their own and not getting the support they need. And it's not very fun to be the only neurologist in the country. It can be a real burnout or pressure for a lot of people. So I think we don't support our field amongst ourselves as much as we could.
In the article, you had mentioned some goals on how we can begin to address some of the issues. You want to talk about those?
Sure. Yeah. So one of the things that I've been interested in doing later in my career now is not just describing the problem, but thinking about like, what can we actually do? And what are concrete measures that we could take to improve the situation? So it's recognized that there are issues, but like, how do we advance? And so I just listed 9 goals that could be considered. These are, you know, my ideas, and I think that they're worth considering. So I'll just list them for you. The first is improving access to diagnostic testing and thinking about point of care testing in particular. And that way patients can even test themselves one day. The second is advancing knowledge directly to patients and healthcare workers. So thinking about the model as going to healthcare workers, but patients as well. And the third is developing best practices and guidelines for low-income settings. So we've been speaking broadly about low and middle-income countries, but particularly in low-income settings, what do we do if we can't get an autoantibody or if we can't get a specific treatment? You know, just to provide guidance, knowing there are places without resources, what's the best practice for those locations? The fourth is generating evidence on treatment choices and dosing of affordable medicines. And so we know that rituximab is used widely for the treatment of NMOSD, and to provide some elements of dosing, timing, safety, and appropriateness. And also to think about if there are situations where you can't get rituximab and you can't get any of our available FDA DMTs, what is the rational dosing for some of the alternatives, even if they're not superior? Number 5 is ensuring that every country has access to immunosuppressive agents on a consistent availability. And that may sound obvious, but it's certainly the case that many countries don't have consistent availability of immunosuppressives. And that is a very basic challenge, but I think, you know, certainly surmountable. Number 6 is negotiating rational drug pricing in low-income countries. And actually, the Clinton Foundation, several years back now, looked at drug pricing and negotiating drug pricing for antiretrovirals and other important antibiotics. And that really changed the field. And so I think we can also do that in neurology. Number 7 is establishing vertical programs for drug delivery. So this is where I mentioned Gleevec and targeting specific patients who really need access to disease-modifying therapies. Number 8 is tracking disease incidence and outcomes to identify missed opportunities. So this is really a request for epidemiology and looking at practices and thinking about what is being done and what could be done that's sort of low-hanging fruit, if you will. And number nine is ensuring continuity of NMO care and thinking about patients as, you know, mobile and throughout their life course, needing to get care, even if they need to move from their current setting, and how to collaborate across locations. That sounds like probably a lot to do, but they're just some sort of morsels of food for thought.
I can appreciate the way that you constructed the goals. As I mentioned before, I think for a lot of us, we frame diagnoses, treatment, and long-term care in a very different manner than the majority of the world. So I think laying them out very specifically to at least start to have those conversations and those discussions and start moving towards looking at solving those problems is very important. Reading through the literature that your work has produced, and it provides a perspective that I don't think many of us really understand. It's important work, and I'm glad that the discussions are happening, and I look forward to see where it goes.
Thank you for covering the topic. So it's not a mainstream topic, and it's not been a mainstream paper. So, but it's still, I think it's really interesting to hear patient perspectives on this too. And to, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who want to help, but there's no blueprint on how to help. So exactly. I think that's the challenge, you know, coming up with legitimate ways people who want to help can actually do it, and not starting from just sort of, you know, kind of ideas randomly, but also to have like needs-based assessments and having, you know, I didn't talk very much about cost effectiveness in this at all, but I think that's another piece of the puzzle. Like if you have X amount of money and, you know, you want to help, how does this, you know, play out? Right. And how much does it really cost to get to where we're going? So those things can be analyzed as well and still need a little bit more work, but that's probably the next step on that. But I, you know, I've never underestimated people's desire to help and to do good things for either other patients or patients that they're studying or patients that they're treating. But it's often unclear how to execute. How do you make it actually happen? And so in neurology, we've been challenged not by a lack of interest, but by a lack of organization. And I think that that's slowly changing and can change faster. That's kind of the idea piece, but powerful organizations can take on the concreteness of it.
I think as the Smyer Foundation has grown globally, the work that you're doing, at least from my point of view, helps frame the work that we're doing. And I think dovetails very well with what our goals are in making sure that patients have access to diagnostics and long-term treatments and can live with a good quality of life, you know, under very, very difficult circumstances.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it just so happens that the Smyer Foundation is based in Boston. And, you know, 10 years ago and change, I took a job in Boston, and so that was really serendipity, really, that this sort of global-minded foundation is right around the corner. But not everyone has that. So, you know, thankfully, the Smyer Foundation has reached many corners of the world now, many countries. It's only growing, and that's really exciting to see someone make this situation that could have stayed local, global. And we actually did a podcast, Samira and I, recently for neurology for the Without Borders section, where I got to ask her, you know, why go global? What are we learning about global NMO? So I got to sort of ask her the questions and see what she's had to say, because now she's seen NMO in many countries and has this very unique perspective. So different opinions coming up, but you know, everybody has a choice whether to go global or not, and Smyer Foundation has, and thank heavens, because I think they're doing a lot of great work.
Well, thank you again for taking time out of your busy schedule to chat with us. I always learn a lot, and I always appreciate your perspective and the body of work that you're produced. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Mm-hmm.